So each woman's experience as a new and expecting mother is different. For some, the changes during pregnancy and having a baby may come easily. For others, there may be physical and mental health struggles. So joining me this morning to discuss the importance of maternal mental health are my guests, Mr. Amit Motwani, CEO of Rupani Foundation.
Hello.
And Mahtab Moradi, behavioral therapist. Together, we are going to learn about Rupani Foundation's maternal mental health initiatives. And Mahtab is going to guide us and navigate us towards care for pregnant women and, you know, after birth as well. So let's just dive right in. I'm not going to do any introductions because we've had them on our show before. And the last time we talked about early childhood education and we learned a lot. And the foundation does really great work. And today we are going to talk about maternal mental health, which is so important for all of us, right?
Yeah, thanks so much for having us on today. You know, and I want to start with a couple of things. First, a little bit about Rupani Foundation. I know we met last time, but it's always good to remind folks that our mission is to share best practices in early childhood development so that families can have their best shot at mental, physical, and economic well-being. And of course, early childhood development really encompasses the worlds of prenatal health, postpartum health, all those things, all those zones, if you will, which are epicentral to the health of the child, the health of the mother, and the health of the family. Mm-hmm. The second thing I wanted to mention is that Mahtab is not only a behavioral health expert with decades of experience, she's also...
giving away my
that's
age.
A good... oh, God. I've got decades of experience in my world. Well, I just wanted to mention that Mahtab also has our back at Rupani Foundation. She's a board member. She's a board member, and we are very, very honored to have her guidance, irrespective of how much experience she brings.
We're always going to stay at the two decade. Like, just moving
I didn't
forward.
Say I didn't say a number of decades, did I? So now who's aging whom?
Don't flip it on me.
I know, right? We had a good start.
Yeah. So I think that this is one of the reasons I've been so excited about what Rupani Foundation is doing.
Yeah.
Because not only they're addressing mental health, but, you know, I've always been a big, you know, fan of why don't we, like, stop the problem from ever happening? Why, as a society, are we so reactive in medicine, in mental health, in just about anything we do? We are a very reactive society. And so I got very excited when Mr. Rupani was talking about this initiative and how progressive. And not only did he define, like, prenatal care, not just from the time of conception, but he's like, you know, with these refugee families, it's like, the minute they get married, the mother-in-law is hounding them. When's the baby coming? When's the baby coming? So when we talk about the mental health of mothers, it almost starts on your wedding night, right? If you really think about it. And, of course, my background as a clinician, I have had a lot of experience when things go really, really bad. When partner relationships are turbulent and suddenly a pregnancy happens. And then there's a fear of God put in that woman where you can't even go tell your OB-GYN what's going on because there's such messy situations at home. So I really want to make it an intention today to normalize talking about those uncomfortable things. And for folks out there to know that there is help, that there is people who understand you, there are people who speak your language who understand you, there are people who live through all of it with, you know, I had one smooth pregnancy and one not so smooth pregnancy. So I'm very transparent about my life experience because I think part of the problem in the healthcare system is that there's this, you know, gap between the human story and the help that's available. And somewhere people at very critical points in their life, they get lost in the system. So that's the storyteller in me, because I feel like you have to fully capture the full narrative of a person before you can start labeling them or addressing the kind of the biology or mental health component.
Yeah, we need to understand it. Like, what, you know, what is maternal mental health? We don't even know. Sometimes when we are going through it, we are so confused, right? We just think it's us. And maybe it'll go away. It's just a bad day. And tomorrow is a new day. So nothing will, you know, things will change. So all of these things, and there are so many things that goes on in our minds at that time. It's so confusing.
Yeah. So one of the things that I run into is that we almost normalize anything that could go wrong. And we make an excuse not to ask for help.
Yes.
Because people say, well, it's just hormones.
But I feel like as women, we tend to just shrug it under the rug that it's okay, you know what? Like, I'm going to take care of me later. Let me take care of everything else first. And that's where I feel like we do ourselves injustice.
Yeah, because, I mean, the minute you sign up to be someone's mom, you owe it to them.
Yeah.
To be at your best, because their livelihood depends on where you are with yourself, right? I mean, even, you know, the amygdala is the emotional regulation part of our brain, right? If you're not happy, if the mom is not happy and they're anxious, the let go response, which is a function of breastfeeding, it shuts down. That's why some women have a difficult time nursing. So, I mean, these are just very, it's common knowledge, but it's the person, are you encouraged to look for it? Do you have a fear of asking for help? What is the culture of your family environment? What is the culture of your relationship? Now it's best practice when the minute you find out you're pregnant, you go to your OB-GYN, and at various points of your pregnancy, they do suicidal, intakes, like if you're having issues with mood, how much anxiety you're experiencing. Because typically we hear, oh, postpartum depression. Well, I didn't have postpartum depression. Mine was diagnosed as postpartum panic disorder. And I remember the day I actually first experienced it. And all my family, they have some sort of, I mean, we have like a cardiologist on call because as a family, we have so many heart issues. I'm like, oh my God, it's my turn. You know, I must be having a heart issue in the middle of a pregnancy. Great. Whoa. And I went to work because I worked literally till the day I gave birth. And lucky for me, I'm a chatterbox. You know, I tell everybody what's wrong with me. So I worked with 12 other clinicians. We took these long lunch breaks, which I always tell them, you guys are the reason I'm not medicated. Because I was like surrounded by the best of the best. And they're like taking care of me like so well. Even to this day, when I get stuck, I'm like, I know who gets off at what time with their various mental health roles. And I'm like, all right, I like Houston traffic. I'm going to put you on speaker and you're going to be my therapist for the next 9 minutes.
The best kind of medicine.
But I'd return the favor. It's not a one-way thing. So, but what I was trying to say is sometimes, you know, that's one of the misinformations.
Yes.
It's not going to look like depression. It's not going to be, you know, your hormones, you can't get out of bed. Sometimes you're going through something, you got plenty of energy. In fact, enough energy to have another child and hold a 60-hour gig. You know, I had a job, I had a private practice. I was go, go, go. There's nothing that looked like clinical depression on me. But there were so many things that were going through my mind that was hindering me. And I would have these episodic, like, panic attacks to the point where I couldn't breathe. And I was in Pilates, in yoga, working out 6 days a week. So none of these things could explain what I was going through. And that's when I started doing the research on, wait, I can't be the only one. You know, everyone, I mean, millions of women have had babies for thousands of years. Like, what's going on? So then I got curious. And when I get curious, I start asking people who've been through something and kind of try to gain something from their wisdom.
Yeah.
And then I kind of put it side to side with my own knowledge and I weigh things out. So I think that needs to be normalized. The fact that at every point in a woman's pregnancy, or even the idea of getting pregnant, maybe you have a you know, you just got married and your family's like, well, you know, your time is ticking. Something needs to happen here? Well, why don't you look at the overall baseline, what I call a baseline of your mental health? When I say baseline, I mean, if your entire life, let's say you've struggled with rapid cycling bipolar disorder, at some point somebody should have a heart-to-heart conversation that maybe motherhood is not for you in the traditional sense, right? Unless you're married to a Hollywood star like Catherine Jones and you can have three nannies around the clock and you just kind of have this thing and then the world around you takes care of it, which most of us don't. So let's get real, right?
Yeah. Of course.
Were you like me? Did you have the genetic loading or disposition for anxiety to begin with before you ever thought about a pregnancy? Chances are you introduce hormones, you introduce all these variables of pregnancy that are not in your control. So it would make sense for those symptoms to be heightened during that time, right? So baseline, where was I before? Was I having the right conversations? What was my game plan to keep these things at bay, right?
Yeah.
So that's kind of the pre, you know, the pre and the post picture. From what I see in the data, it says once a woman gets pregnant, it's like this switch goes on. So you are going to be at a different kind of regulation mode that whole entire time. Even if you have a miscarriage, apparently, even if you have a miscarriage, it takes time for your brain to turn the switch off. Okay, guys, we don't need to make a baby anymore. Mm-hmm. We're done here. And then you have these like dives and the not so good feelings. And not just the sadness of grieving a baby, but a little bit more exaggerated.
Yeah.
So in that time, I don't care what religion you are, or what your spouse thinks, my gosh, get 10 milligrams of an SSRI. I mean, it's not a permanent thing.
Yeah.
Right as you know, when you ride those hormones out at about 18 months, talk to your doctor, wean me off. I'm done with this thing.
Right.
So it's kind of those type of questions.
Yeah. So how is the foundation, with maternal mental health? What is the foundation doing?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think, you know, I could segue into that a little bit by jumping off of the notion that when you're looking, you know, Matt, you mentioned that refugee families especially have unique circumstances, whether it's immediately after getting married and what that family structure looks like. And I might suggest that if we even zoom out further, and let's just say not necessarily looking only at refugee families, but all maybe immigrant families, or at least Asian immigrant families, for example, we share a lot of this in common with, you know, whom we're calling maybe refugee families. We have a lot of the same cultural norms, a lot of the same cultural stigmas, a lot of the same in-law challenges, and certainly, I think, in most cases, certainly many cases, we share a lot of the same sort of disproportionate burdens that we put on women in our cultures, as well as mothers in our cultures. And so I think, you know, of course, I can't speak on the data, and I'm certainly, as a man in the room, doing my best to sort of speak very speculatively and be clear about it, but it's almost as if the dismissiveness around concerns, oh, it's just hormones or, oh, it's just a thing, you know, it's a phase. It's almost as if that's fueled very much by the men in the culture, things that we don't understand, we often dismiss. And I think, you know, I think there are plenty of examples of that. I don't need to necessarily jump into them. But, you know, my larger point is that this is all families. And if we zoom out from Asian families, I think we could look at the same kind of questions, which are stigma, whether that's a lack of education, a lack of being informed around mental health disorders and what that means, and a lack of understanding that it's just really the same as a broken leg or a heart condition, you know, that we either need to treat with physical therapy or some sort of therapy or medication or what have you. I think a second is access, whether that means having the financial resources to access care, whether that means our insurance coverage includes, you know, quality behavioral health care, or really, if it includes understanding the systems enough. And I think access is a really interesting point of confusion for a lot of us. For example, you know, if somebody were to mention to me rapid cycling bipolar, I might say, whoa, what is that? You know, or if somebody were to mention to me, yes, your child might have some behavioral health concerns, would like to refer you possibly to a therapist. There is a good one that's covered under your insurance. You can wait 6 weeks for them. You know, they'll do CBT, DBT, and a couple of other abbreviations. And, you know, as a parent, we may be like, what are they talking about? Or someone's like, well, there's a hypnotherapist over here. And you're like, hypnotherapy? Whoa, is that a pendulum? Like, what's going on? And so it's like, how do we decode that stuff? So access is really, really a big nested mess that's also founded, I think, in education. And then finally, it's the workforce. I mean, I think there's a bottleneck. When I mentioned a six-week wait, that's on a good day if you're waiting for a therapist or an expert. And so the foundation is really looking, Rupani Foundation is really looking to address in those three areas around stigma, outreach and education, how we can help navigate and support access. And, you know, if there are any systemic ways we can support in improving the workforce challenges when it comes to
translation. Mr. Rupani said he's got like 10 different languages. The educational material.
Wow.
So it's exciting. This is going to be a really great.
There's so much thought put into that because, like you said, language, we don't even, you know, think about that, right? Usually it's just a couple of languages, but this is, it's amazing because you're like reaching to a vast majority of people that way.
Yeah.
That's super important. And, you know, in language, again, it brings me back to base one, which is that. And I was thinking about this the other day as we were translating an assessment, a children's trauma assessment, into a couple of languages from Afghanistan. And I was thinking, wow, even in English, like, this is tough. Like, you know, I mean, we could translate to other languages all day long. And of course, that is super important. Like, without that, we don't have that lens. But I feel like we need like a translation course just for what's going on in English. You know, and you know, for those of us who speak English,
what's going on, then we'll do the language.
It's like, wait, what do all
CBT,
these
CBT.
Things mean? You know?
Understand all of those.
You know, and I'm lucky and privileged to have access to the information I need to be able to study and learn those things. I'm privileged to be able to have access to, you know, a good therapist. You know, I'm privileged to understand how to navigate my system, even though it's super challenging for me. However, there's so many fundamental ways that we need to really, really be able to address this. And I think that's really why we're blessed to have a board member like Mehtab on board, who not only brings the industry domain expertise, but also the lens of cultural competence, which is required for us to be family-centered and human-centered and with the families whom we're serving.
I'm glad I'm able to do that because again, when you're going through something and people don't understand what your pain is, that's so frustrating. You know, I remember when I was doing my fellowship in UTMB, and because I had a funny last name, anybody who was foreign, and back then we had fax machines. So the referrals would come through this fax. And, you know, imagine I just come alive, like I passed my board and I'm so excited. I would like, you know, dust my little certificates on my wall. Like now I don't even know like where some of them are. And I get excited every time I get a referral with my name. Because I mean, it's like somebody needs me, you know, like, hey. And I get it. And they are already, like, my boss had left. And I was working at this off-site clinic because it was the Four Seas clinic, the indigent care. We had, like, four satellite clinics. And it said, you know, couple issues, marital and, like, other dysfunctions like intimacy and all that, and then it said Spanish speaking only. And I said, are you kidding me? And I had two interns who were like supposed to be watching me,
right?
And I'm supposed to be setting an example. I said, oh no. Just this is
because
not
you're
happening.
The cultural one or what? Like, it just
yeah.
You
because Moradi, like, I mean, I guess Moradi can be Italian.
Yeah.
I don't know, but I'm like, are you kidding me? I felt like my grandfather was playing a joke on me. So anyway, and you know, this is why I always joke with Amit about his whiteboard, because he like he doodles and thinks like with as he draws. Well, I had one of those. I had one of those in my office, so I literally did a session doing Pictionary.
Oh.
Because I didn't want to turn this Hispanic man away. I mean, he admitted to all these very, like, hefty problems and coming to get help with his wife. Like, are you kidding me? That's not, I mean, that's why I got into this profession, right? So I'm like, okay, I don't know Spanish, but I can draw and yeah. I can act things out, you know?
Well, that's what the work takes, really, is like, I mean, we ain't scared to jump in with some Pictionary if we have to. And that speaks to the dedication of our team. Niloufar, who was here last time, Niloufar Ali, who heads the team, and our fantastic team of frontline, you know, facilitators, navigation specialists. And it really, really makes sense, again, that we have that kind of leadership on our board, too. You know, we'll bring Pictionary to the game if we have to. And that'll be phase one, and we'll continue to iterate from there. What's next? What's next? How do we bring a specialist in or an expert in to take Pictionary to a translation, from a translation to a curriculum, mm-hmm. from a curriculum to sessions? And and so, yeah, I really actually I appreciate that story, because it's not far from likely some experiences our team has had.
You got to help people. That, I mean, so part of their issue was, you know, they were a very young couple and they wanted to have a baby.
Do we need to take a break? I just see you giving me signs.
Come on.
Okay. Sorry, guys. Okay, all right. So we're going to go a short break. And when we return, we will continue our conversation with Amit Motwani and Mata Moradi of Rupani Foundation. Chai Time on 99.5 FM. Welcome back to Chai Time on 99.5 FM. I am in conversation with Mr. Amit Motwani and Mahtab of Rupani Foundation. And the topic of discussion for the day is maternal mental health. So before, you know, I had to rudely cut you off, Mahtab. Let's continue. Okay.
Yeah, I thought we had to go on break because you said the F word, fax machines. I don't know. Do they bleep that out? Or what? Oh, I guess it was a standard break. I'm sorry. No, back to that.
We had to go on break to kind of control her.
Yeah. Control the word. You can't say that anymore.
No fax machine.
What's a fax machine?
Oh, stop it.
And then Sasha mentions about Google Translation, and we are like, Sasha.
Okay, you know, it's like back in 98. Also high school then.
I love it. Hey, you know, you earn it.
Anyways, let's continue.
Okay. So I'm going to be the serious one now. I know that, you know, when Amit was talking about like CBT, DBT, these are all kind of terminologies of best practices. Like, for example, cognitive behavioral therapy. helps a patient to navigate around problematic thinking errors that maybe hinder them in their progress, or maybe they don't ask for help, maybe because of a cultural narrative, a family script, like asking help is a weakness, or what do you mean? You know, our ancestors, everyone before you became a mom, they didn't need all this. Why are you so dramatic? Why are you, you know? So it's important to, I think, have a space for everyone to actually talk about, you know, it's not just this problem that I'm living with or waking up anxious or depressed or unmotivated or having anxiety attacks about how I'm going to be as a mom to this new baby, or what if I get pregnant, I lose the baby, and these people are going to be running after me saying I tricked their son into marriage because they expected a baby first year. You know, there's all these things that go into this picture. And then to also, like, you have to put yourself first. That is your body. You are taking the risk. So one thing that I really want to highlight, besides, you know, I know I get goofy sometimes, but before ever thinking about pregnancy, it's very important that you are aware that physiologically your body needs to be at a place. If you have a body fat that's so low, it's actually harder to conceive. You want to be on prenatal vitamins 6 months prior. You want to pay attention to folic acid. These things prevent a lot of, like, brain disorders that may happen. You want to be more intentional about your lifestyle. You do not want to be drinking and smoking, even smoking hookah. Like, treat your body right. Trust me, our great-grandmothers did not pull these things. They were not in Vegas and then come home and get, you know, have a baby. So, like, let's, you know, if you don't know how to cook, maybe you should learn how to cook. Now you have this other life, you know. It's, maybe you need to make adaptations to your life to get ready, mentally get ready for motherhood, right? So how well you take care of yourself. If you do have a mental health issue prior to pregnancy, you know, a universal benchmark for mental health is 6 months of being clear from any symptom that prevents you from functioning in your daily life. So if your depression, if your anxiety, if your OCD, panic disorder, whatever your label is before pregnancy, if it was not managed, it probably is not a good idea to introduce this new life and put yourself on a hormonal roller coaster.
Well, you know, that makes me think, for example, if I were to, say, be an individual who has high blood pressure, would it also probably be a good thing for me to get something like that under control for and feel like I have that symptomology managed and regulated for a good period of 6 months before entering parenthood? Yeah, and so it's the same, you know, and I think we often lose sight of equating mental health and physical health in the same ways, especially when we're looking at life-changing events or diabetes or what have you.
No, that's a great point. I think people, if we learn to speak of it in those terms, I'm well managing, right? And then there's also the measure of relationship health, right? That's a, I don't know, maybe my mom says I take motherhood too seriously compared to some folks, but I'm like, it is the most important thing, I think.
Yeah.
Right.
I agree.
I build my whole life and my schedule around my kiddos. And even before, I never smoked a cigarette until, well, I still haven't smoked one. Maybe I need to get to it. No, I'm just kidding. But I actually was very intentional about how I treated my body, knowing that one day I want to be in that position to have a healthy pregnancy. And I was very open to my OB-GYN about my anxiety. I'm like, I come from a line of anxious people, and then I've got, you know, heart disease and diabetes. So she kept me in check. She yelled at me. I had this grumpy French OB-GYN, Dr. Vandel. I love her to death. I like people who are smart, even if they're going to be a little grumpy. I'll live with that. But she yelled at me after Thanksgiving for gaining like 2 pounds. And I was pregnant. And I'm like, oh my God, in my culture, I would be praised. But thank you, yeah. Because you know I have diabetes in my family. You know I've got heart disease. So I appreciate you calling me out. And it won't happen again.
Yeah, well, that makes me think, actually, you know, we speak a lot about, I guess, in the industry or in the arena about integrated behavioral health. Mm-hmm. And, you know, my understanding of that is that that's really looking at mental health as a component of overall health, really looking at mental health and physical health together, especially in our care system. So what are some points that, you know, I think we have a long way to go before this IBH practice is sort of standardized. Mm-hmm. But what are some points that in a good system we might look forward to where our sort of our traditional primary care doctors or physicians or maybe our OBGYNs might stop and say, hey, let's make sure we have this assessment or let's make sure what are some bright lines for us? Because I think a lot of us, you know, we may think, wow, I'm just down. I need mental health support. Where do I start? If I talk to my, you know, a lot of us may not occur to us that we should ask our primary care doctor. Yeah. Oh, you know, yeah. I'll go, we'll get, you know, the stethoscope is here and I can mention, by the way, I'm kind of stressed out and I might be depressed. And they can say, mm-hmm. We actually have an assessment for that. And then I can tell you what to do next. I mean, or where are the points that you think that we need to be ready for so we could maybe look for help or find like these branches into care? Mm-hmm.
So I think a lot of women actually find out they're pregnant much later. Hmm. And there's also, and like, you know, being Persian, like it's really wrong to announce a pregnancy until like 3 months. 3 months. I'm like, oh my gosh, okay, that's a new one, right? I grew up here. So even within when we actually report, so you may not have an OB/GYN from the get-go. Mm-hmm. Yes. So you gotta have a relationship with your PCP or primary care physician so that you can have that conversation where you're like, you know, I don't know, this is not my baseline. I'm sleeping in, I'm grumpy, my friends call me to go to yoga, I'm turning them down, that's not me. Or I'm agitated. You know, irritability is like a key indication of depression. Mm. You know, people say, oh, anger management. I'm like, no, that's untreated depression. We're scripted men are scripted to show irritability through anger because it's more powerful. It's more masculine. But if your guy is constantly irritable, like he can do really well on a good SSRI. You know, he'll be the sweet guy you knew when you first met him. So we have to break down all these walls. Mm. And for, you know, a good primary care office would have, like, access to the Beck depression inventory, Beck anxiety inventory, little short symptomatic checklist. Another gatekeeper is the sleep. You know, how are you regulating sleep? If you maybe had a mood disorder before getting pregnant and, you know, maybe rapid cycling or whatever, insomnia is the first alarm. Insomnia and not being able to stop and, like, you know, pressured speech. You know, there's a lot of components where you kind of have mental health just doesn't come at you like one morning. Hmm. It has a lot of warnings. And I can't say enough about relationship health. This is something people don't talk about. It's the scariest thing. Imagine the most vulnerable thing is to say to somebody, I love you and I want to put everything in my life. This is, you know, all bets are on you. And then, like, in our cultures, to take the risk of, like, making another human, you know. For some of us, I mean, we're lucky we live on this side of the world. But, like, I'm divorced. I'm a single mom. I have 2 kids. Like, for me, in other countries, it would be game over.
Yeah.
Right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's, imagine how different our lens is. and how important that relationship assessment is. How important it is. It's not that you're being high maintenance to want the father of your baby to go to a silly appointment and they hear the heart or take, you know, blood or check your sugar levels. It's more than that. It's, what did I sign up for? Or I, this one I hate. Well, it hasn't hit me because the baby lives in her. I'm like,
oh.
We can be pretty terrible.
But Mahtab, how do you simplify it for women who, you know, like who have no education or who have like gone through this culture, you know, for generations, right? Through their mom and grandmother and all. So how would you talk to them and simplify it like it for in the foundation itself? Because you all come across a lot of women. So how do you talk to them? Because what we are talking now is probably for majority of the women who's listening is like, you know, educated or working moms. And but just, you know, like for regular, for moms who are, who's not educated, who's on the low poverty line, how do we, how do you educate them or make them understand all the things that what we are talking about?
I've got a lot of thoughts about it, but I also think I should take a back seat because there's a lot I can learn from listening
to those of us in the room. So actually, this is why the way we have approached like the fatherhood groups, the groups with the focus groups with the mom, you have when there's an old saying, you know, you don't want to fix what's not broken. If there is a functioning definition of a relationship in the cultural context and it's working, it is unethical of me to go shake things up. You only have to have where you can be helpful and respectful of that boundary of the culture. I can't go in a facility and say, oh my God, he talks to you like that, leave him. Well, yeah, five, no, because that's poverty. That's a woman, you got to look at the full picture, right? So what I like to think of is you do very strategic assessment and you almost prep like with a, you know, a mid going in, because when we thought about the fatherhood groups, the idea of me going by myself was in question. So one of our strategies was like, you know, we're not even going to call this any kind of mental health anything. We are going to lean into this concept of in every one of these cultures, one thing that we have in common is everybody's about family. Right. So we are going to capitalize on that. And so I needed his help. to do, and you can talk more about that. Like, I love that experience.
I could talk all day about the fatherhood groups, which, you know, definitely feed into a larger picture notion of how do we meet families sort of where they are to be able to get the same information we've been talking about here distilled in a way that will be received by them, and you know, so that they may be able to use that, again, to pursue better outcomes. And I think the number one notion is that the same stuff we're talking about here, that a lot of us who have the blessing of education and opportunity, we can understand, and a lot of us really still don't understand.
Yeah.
It's the same information that we need to be sharing with families we serve who may not yet have had the same access to opportunity. It's the same issues of stigma of like mental health mean, you know, oh, I've got a mental health disorder. That doesn't mean you're crazy. That doesn't mean, you know, that you're, oh, stay away from them, you know? And I feel like we have so much stigma, even in the most Western of Western culture, around that. That being said, if we're sharing the same information, the number one avenue for exchange of that information is trust. And something that Rupani Foundation, I think just through intrinsic work of our board chair and founder, Mr. Rupani, who's been leading this kind of work all over the world, but also Niloufar Ali and her team, one thing they've done a really great job of is building trust with the communities we work with. So sharing best practices in early childhood development, sharing resources that families ask for, it shows that we're listening and we can be trusted. And we do what we say we're going to do. this has opened up an avenue for us to now be able to share public health information that will be trusted. So we can now start saying these same things. Your mental health disorder is the same as a broken arm, or it's the same as your high blood pressure, or, and those notions can start to resonate. Then it's the next step. Hey, you've been set up already with a physician through Medicaid or through a low-cost community clinic provider. Maybe you should ask them if they can do one of these simple 9-question assessments for depression or anxiety, you know, 7 questions for anxiety. And it's just, do you have this? Do you have this? Do you have trouble sleeping? Or do you have you sleep too much? It's very simple questions. Mm-hmm. And if we can share these first steps in a way that are trusted, I feel like we can start to make a difference. And we see that already, and we've done that, again, by meeting families where they are. When we did a focus group for women on mental health, they loved it. They participated. No surprise, Mehtab was leading it. And they also said, we need this for the dudes. So we came back and we brought it for the men, right? Yeah. And then Mehtab helped guide. You know, I was like, I don't want to say mental health anything. She was like, well, one thing we all have in common is we all want to be great parents. And so really, really honing in on shared values and trust, I think, helps us do that.
Yeah. No, I know you guys think I offend people all the time, but I'm actually really smooth on that.
We laugh some of them.
What are your thoughts of it?
Well, I'm not the one who went to break.
Yeah, I think that, you know, when we know better, we tend to do better. I mean, look at us. Well, I'm an immigrant. If something is more fluid, easier, it gives you results, why not? Like, are we hanging our clothes to dry when we have this awesome dryer? Makes everything smell good? Oh, heck no. I'm not going to go back to what my grandmother did. So it is kind of the same thing. And then just having it, this has been my survival all along. Like, have a sense of humor about every angle of life, because it's not always going to be great things happening, awesome, and internalize it and use the resources around you to empower yourself. And speak up when you're not having a good day. Be transparent. Don't, like, emotionally vomit on everybody and, you know, put them out of what they need to, you know, be doing to be productive. But it's good to normalize that, right?
Yeah. Yeah, I agree.
Normalizing is a super important part of it. And I sometimes feel like I very over-intentionally do my part to normalize it. There were times, you know, in my past where I would have felt awkward if someone were speaking about their therapist. And now, I mean, I wouldn't blink. You know, to me, it's like, oh, yeah, okay. So, you know, you just, it's like anything else that someone's doing. In fact, when I know that somebody is actually participating in counseling or therapy, I think, oh, wow. You know, especially in the corporate world, I think, oh, okay, there's someone I got to watch out for. But that person has a leg up. That person,
growth,
you know,
mindset.
Yeah, that person is growing. And so, you know, that's someone either to watch as a mentor, to be competitive with, or what have you, you know. And I feel the same personally. And so I do my best to try to over almost normalize it, because exposure, I believe, is an important conduit to normalizing things. Yeah, and to speak about things absent of stigma is to model that stigma isn't there, right? We all kind of have to take that step. Mm-hmm. And I think bringing it into the mainstream is important. Another thing our board chair and founder, Mr. Nasruddin Rabbani, is doing, he chairs a clinic called Ibn Sina. And they are building a huge new mental health center there on their campus, and leading a Muslim mental health initiative, which is something new, I think, especially that all of our cultures can learn from and model from. Again, about bringing mental health into the mainstream, teaching faith leaders what are, you know, early interventions, and how can we navigate people? How can we be familiar with these simple assessments that can be given to tell someone, hey, you might have depression? You know, because faith leaders are hubs. They're very, very important areas of torque. And so I think normalizing is really important. I love hearing everybody talking about it, because it needs to be talked about more.
Yeah.
And my big thing is, you know, it's okay to have a problem. It's not okay to do nothing about it. you know, and this is what I tell my kids all the time. I'll hear you out, but mm-hmm. I do not believe in learned helplessness when you've got resources, when you've got possible solutions. So that's why I kind of left the therapy world and I do the mindset, because I'm like, we are kind of, as a society, we are ill in the ways we think. We create problems.
So true.
So I'm like, let me go work on that side for a couple of decades. And mess with some people. No, I'm just kidding.
Yeah. It's true. We have choices, right? It's,
oh, yeah.
We, you know, whenever we say, oh, we don't have an option or we don't have choices. No. In everything that you do, you have a choice.
Yes.
You make
the choice. I do it scared. I go to work scared. I go to work anxious, rejected, all of the above. Unless I feel like I'm going to give someone COVID or a disease, I will still show up for what I need to do. I think that's really important. Yeah. Just like if you've got hypertension, you take your blood pressure medication and you still go to work. You know, in fact, a lot of our cardiologists have hypertension, right? Mm-hmm. Like, talk about modeling. I'm still going to go do what I need to do.
Yeah.
But I take my meds, yeah. Right?
Yeah. You take care of yourself and you take care of others.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I always say, especially my first client, I'm like, I need to be transparent. If I'm off my game, this is a matter I may be preoccupied with.
Yeah.
And I appreciate you being forgiving and being flexible. If we're 20 minutes into it and you're just not getting anything out of me, let's reschedule. If I feel like I can't put my best in there, I'll reschedule.
Yeah. Yeah. Wow, the time has gone by so fast. I hope we covered most of the things we wanted to talk about. But, you know, before we wrap up, anything else we should cover?
I just really appreciate you all giving the importance and airtime, literally, to the subject that needs to be normalized most, I think, in our arena. And so, you know, I mentioned the Muslim Mental Health Initiative that Ibn Sina was putting on. You all can look forward to them also putting on an interfaith mental health conference later toward the end of the year. And I think that's something Rupani Foundation will be participating in. Anybody who's here, who's listening right now, anyone, of course, in the room, should let us know if y'all are interested in participating in that. And other than that, just thank you. Thank you so much. Metta?
You know, I love words. And I don't know, when you said that, it made me think of a quote. And it goes something like, if you want to show your children you love them, love their mother.
Beautiful.
That's my...
Yay! Thank you. Thank you so much for taking the time out and joining us this morning. It was a really great conversation and an important one to talk about.
Thank you.
We really appreciate it.
Thank you. Thank you, listeners, for tuning into Chai Time. Don't forget the clothing drive this Saturday at Arlings. Drop off your clothes and support Daya Houston. Signing off, Chai Time 99.5 FM.